Good afternoon. Today is Friday, the 7th of May 2021. I am Lynn Sturm and I have been given the privilege of interviewing Paul Mooney, Chief Winemaker for the Mission Estate Winery in Tarradale. Over to you.
Right. Okay. I was born in Clyde in central Otago and I was one of eight children. My father there was a local barrister and solicitor and my mother was a homemaker. I lived there till I was 11 until we shifted to Hamilton, at which point my father was appointed to the bench as a magistrate. So the school I went to in Alexandra was St. Jude's Primary School and it was run by the Sisters of Mercy, the nuns. When we moved to Hamilton, I started at intermediate, Melville Intermediate, for 2 years. From there, I went to St. John's College for a year. And then I went on to Sacred Heart College for 3 years where I was a boarder. On finishing at Sacred Heart in Auckland, in my last year at school, I decided not to carry on and I went to Waikato University instead. I studied for a bachelor's degree in science and my majoring subject was physics. Once I completed that, it took me 4 years to get that degree, so on completion, it took me 6 or 7 months to find a permanent job, and I got a job working for, that time was the Ministry of Transport, and they administered 2 meteorological stations. The Met Service was under the Ministry of Transport, but they ran 2 meteorological observatories, one in Campbell Island and one round. So I went for a year down to Campbell Island on that expedition from 76 to 77. So I did work, because I don't study physics, I did work, I was like a geophysics technician, and I worked there on the island for what was in the DSIR, and I also looked after a couple of the experiments run by the physics departments of Auckland and Otago University. So I came back from there after a year and got a brief job for a multinational company called Schlumberger, which was called a wireline service organisation, and I didn't stick with that. I was a trainee, but I didn't hang out there. So after about 3 or 4 months I left, and then I was going to go back to university to do postgraduate studies, but then the opportunity of this position at Mission Estate came on, and so I took that opportunity, and that was in 1979. So I started here at Mission in March 1979, and since then I've worked at the same place, the same company, since 1979. The company is owned by the Society of Mary, who've owned this business for over 150 years or something.
I'm amazed.
And they're still the shareholder. So this company is probably one of the oldest companies in New Zealand, still running under the same shareholder. And it's been producing and selling wine since the 1870s. Yeah, it's been actually selling wine commercially since the 1870s. So that's 140 years it's been actually selling wine, you know, under this Mission brand. So it's quite a unique situation, and it's an organisation that Merritt's fathers set up. They came here as missionaries and they set up a lot of Maori missions in New Zealand and also sent missionaries to the islands and even places as far away as South America like Peru and Brazil. And they also set up 5 or 6 secondary boys' schools in New Zealand. So Pompeo College, and then you've got St. John's College here, you've got St. Patrick's, Kilburn and St. Patrick's, Silverstream, and you've got St. Bede's in Christchurch, and I think there's another one in Timaru. When I arrived in 1979, we had a seminary here. They operated a seminary where men were trained to be priests, and there was something like about 60 or so students at that time. And there was an academic staff of about 6 or 8, and there were about half a dozen brothers as well. I call them lay brothers. So my old boss, who you've interviewed, he was one of the lay brothers, and he was a winemaker prior to myself. And I was under his tutelage for 3 years, and then he went off, and his aspiration was always to do missionary work. So he realised this aspiration of his to do missionary work. I think when he came here to live a religious life, I think that was his perhaps goal, but I think at the time they needed a winemaker, and as he was trained as a pharmacist, he had the right qualifications to actually run the winery. And he was quite a bright sort of man and innovative. So he started as a winemaker in the early 60s, I think, succeeded brother Basil, and he introduced the first Metho Traditionnel in New Zealand, amongst many other sort of innovations. So, next I married, I met my wife actually back in 1981 to be future wife, but we didn't marry till about 1988. And we were married for about 25 years, but she contracted a very, very aggressive cancer and passed away back in 2012. But meanwhile, we've had five children. So, yeah, I've five children. So that is the basic guts of my background, my history. So I've been working here since 1979. And the production's grown from, quite a small base to a reasonable size now. I think when we started here, we're probably only doing about 200,000 or 300,000 litres, but we're probably about 10 times that now, the volume that we're putting through here. But we're not a big wine company.
You're just going along nicely, so to speak, not trying to get at the top of the market sort of thing.
Oh, no. We're a winery, so we have a shareholder, and the shareholder, we're important for our shareholder because our dividend helps support their operations and activities and their work. So we have, for our wine, probably a quite strong distribution in New Zealand. Probably about sort of 80% or so of our wine is domestic. 80 to 90 is domestic and the rest is export. We're trying to develop an export market, but our brand is not all that well known overseas, but our brand is quite strong in New Zealand. We've got quite good distribution to the supermarkets, but most of the market in New Zealand is for wines in the $10 to $20 price bracket. So that's where we operate. We manage to make it work, even though it's very, very, very competitive. And the profitability of wineries has been compromised over the last 10 or so years, ever since the global financial crisis, really. It's become quite difficult. And the distribution system is tough as well, because basically we've got a duopoly, we've got two big supermarket chains. And yeah, so that's quite a challenge, but we do a bit of other third-party work for other customers. So that's part of our winemaking mix. So, for example, I think we put through close to 3 million litres last year, and I think we've bottled about a couple of million litres that year. We've got two brands, the Mission brand, and 4 years ago we acquired the Stables brand, which was known as Nataroa Wines, but now this is our brand. So what else? Our vineyards used to be concentrated all in Hawke's Bay, and prior to about 2011, we were quite heavily reliant on growers and our own vineyards. But back in 2012, after the global financial crisis, we managed to pick up a vineyard in Marlborough, a 70-hectare vineyard, which has been very, very useful for us, particularly seeing as the market has become so difficult in the last 10 years. So this has given us a supply of Marlborough Sauvignon Blanc. And Marlborough Sauvignon Blanc makes up about 80% of New Zealand's wine exports. It's so important in the overseas market. So that's been strategically very, very good for us to acquire that vineyard. That's helped our business immensely. We also have this vineyard here, which is quite sort of heavy country sometimes, and it's suitable for mid-tier wines. We have two vineyards on the Gimlet Gravels. First we acquired in 1993, the second in about 2003. And they supply fruit for our high-end wines that we sell at over the $20 price point. And these are barrel-aged wines. We only do about 120 or so thousand litres of these barrel-aged wines, so that's wines for the high end of the market. So we are trying to operate in that end of the market, but it's quite difficult because in New Zealand there's not a very, very high demand for full-bodied or expensive whites or reds. But anyway, that's part of our mix. But the core of the mix that the winery takes is these wines we sell in the $10 to $20 price points. We've got wines under a Nataroa brand, like Pinot Grigio and Sauvignon Blanc, that on promotion, are under $12. And they're good quality wines. They're good. And I know that they match up with some of the wines out in the market there that sell for $14, $15, $16 more. We've got a winery, because we've got a sense of scale now and we've got good efficiencies, our costs of production are quite low, so we can actually produce wines that meet those price points that are of high quality and still manage to be able to deliver a dividend for our shareholder.
What is your responsibility being the chief winemaker?
Oh, I'm responsible for the winery production. 20 years ago, I used to do all the purchasing of the dry goods,
even do maintenance of the bottom line, run the lab, monitor the fermentations. I used to do a great big range of stuff. But now we've grown to a point where to cover some of those tasks that I was doing over 20 years ago, we've got now like a logistics planner, a production planner, and those two look after their bottling and exports. And then two winemakers, plus another person that works in the lab, plus we run a bottling line. I've got a guy running that, and we have half a dozen bottling staff. We have three people in the warehouse now, dispatching orders and preparing export orders. Yeah, and then we have sort of three or four people or so working in the cellar doing all the winemaking. So my job is more sort of management, less hands-on. I still do quite a bit of hands-on work from time to time. I'm involved with like strategic planning and aspects of the human resources and that sort of thing. So the overall running of this winery is my responsibility. So it's very different from when Stuart was here, you know, Stuart Cousins, Brother Stuart. Another thing we do is we run an environmental management system. We've been doing that for about 20 years now. We have ISO 14001 accreditation, which audits our environmental management system. And through the initiatives of that, you know, I guess the main thing is, you know, the environmental impact of our operations. If you like to try and be as green or as environmentally conscious as possible, or conscious of the environment and the way that our operations impact on the environment. So this works around water use, waste use, energy use. So we've got like really, really low energy use considering the amount of wine that we're producing. We've got a very, very low carbon footprint. Yeah, because we don't use any fossil fuels or anything in the winery to run boilers or anything like that. So you could ask me some questions.
20 years ago, how many hours were you putting in a week then?
Oh, much the same. Throughout the year, it tends to be like a 40 to 45 hour week. But I come in quite a bit on the weekends. Sometimes I'll often need to monitor refrigeration or do whatever. But over the winter time, that hours are longer, but you know, get up to about 60 or so hours a week. But back in the 1980s and 90s, when our equipment wasn't that good, even though we're doing much more of tonnage, typically over the vintage months, you know, you'd have a month where you'd be working for like 70 or 80 hour weeks. And it's quite physical work too, you know. So if you do an 80 hour work, physically demanding work in a winery, you tend to get quite tired. But the vintage is quite an interesting part of the year. You get very, very focused on the production and getting the harvest in. So there's a lot more to focus on. And there are aspects that impact on not only our viability as a business, or our sustainability as a business, but often the sustainability and viability of other businesses, such as, you know, our growers, for example. You know. So things like harvest decisions and that sort of thing, myself in conjunction with the viticulturist and the winemakers, we have to make. Yes, that's one thing about this job, and it's quite different. So, you know, you've got sort of 10 months of the year you're running this production, you know, this winemaking and bottling, but then you have the 2 months of vintage where actually you're producing the wines when you have the grape intake, and you know, the whole focus changes. That's what makes the job, I guess, challenging and interesting. And every vintage is different, you know, and you face different challenges every year. But, you know, with experience, you do know how to take on those challenges, you know, without, you know, getting too much stressed about it.
I guess the weather, that's the one thing that you can't predict beforehand.
No, that's right, no. So we were going into La Nina this year. Often those have quite wet vintages. We've had three quite good dry vintages. And so this summer was supposed to be La Nina, which was supposed to be, you know, possibly in the years we were La Ninas. We often had like quite heavy rainfall during the grape maturation time, which puts a lot of disease pressure on the ripening fruit. And, you know, sometimes grapes have to be harvested at suboptimal levels of maturity. But again, we've had like 1920, 21. So this is another year where we've had good settled weather through the autumn, and we've been able to hang the fruit, get it fully mature. And as a consequence, you know, we've had, you know, there's about the third or fourth good vintage in a row. Sometimes you get a year like 2017 where you get like a big dump of rain came through in February. Quite heavy rain, and then had another one in mid-March, you know. That was when the reds were getting close to maturity, so that put on a lot of disease pressure. So we had to harvest
You know, we're out there making harvest decisions, basically, you know, to save the fruit. But the 2017 vintage turned out all right. I mean, the wines weren't just as good as in years such as this latest one, but they were okay. They were just a bit lighter.
So you can say you've had a good vintage this year?
Yeah. Around harvest, you know, you can do a point, you're into sort of like risk management. Yeah. So a year like 2017, we had another very, very big heavy dump of rain in April. Yeah, very wet. So we get vintages like that. And another one, which was even worse than that, or more difficult than that, was 2012, where not only did we have a cold summer, at least the summer in 2017 was hot, but in 2012 we had a cold summer and a wet vintage. So that was a very challenging vintage. So we have good ones and bad ones.
And so in the good times, do you put some funds aside to cover the bad times?
We tend to do that, yep. So what we call the vintage wines, or the high quality wines, we will tend to make more in the top years, give ourselves like a bit of a buffer, yeah.
What about Cyclone Bola that year?
That's 1988, yeah, I remember that, yes.
That would have been a bad year.
Yeah, the summer was okay. It was probably a bit of a La Nina year, but it started. I think Gisborne got that far worse than us.
Because they end up with the rivers silting up and farmers losing their land. And you can still see the scars.
I think the very, very heavy rainfall sort of stopped at Tongariro. I think Napier wasn't hit so badly, but it still was very, very heavy. I remember that we had a block of Chardonnay out there. The fruit was looking really, really good. And then that cyclone came along, and it was like 2 or 3 days of very, very heavy rain, and then quite warm and humid. But we had a block of Chardonnay here, and we thought, oh, we'll try and hang it. You know, it'll dry out, but it didn't, it just collapsed. It sort of like, we had problems with excess pressure. And we still made wine, but yeah, I remember Cyclone Bola. Yeah, very, very wet. It wasn't a great vintage because of that heavy cyclone. But saying that, I mean, I think 2017, like we had about 3 very, very heavy rainfall events. But I think Gisborne got very, very badly hit. Yeah, I think there were some vineyards back then.
Did they get more or less wiped out?
No, well, the water level rose and the river flooded, and some vineyards were actually submerged, so there were actually grapes still on the vine and harvested. And then when the water subsided, there was one particular block, we got fruit from up there, came down in a truck, and the fruit had been underwater. And it was okay, it didn't.
Hadn't rotted or anything?
Rotten, it was okay, but we harvested it, put it through the crusher. So the crusher just steamer gets rid of their stalks and, of course, matter other than grapes. And this is for machine harvest fruit. And what happened was a trout got harvested with the grapes and popped out the end of the crusher and the steamer.
That sounds a tall story, Paul.
It's true.
What sort of trout? Was it a brown trout or a rainbow trout?
Just a little one, about a 1 pounder.
It's a fishy story.
There's lots of stories about Cyclone Bola. Yeah, it was very, very heavy. Yeah, so in the 80s, I think, we had quite good weather conditions, I think, for grape growing in Hawke's Bay. I think the 90s wasn't all that good, really. Back in 1992, Mount Pinatubo, 89 and 1990 were very, very good vintages. In 91, they were all 3 very good vintages. But then in 92, Mount Pinatubo erupted in the Philippines, and I don't think there's been an eruption since, because it threw up so much dust into the upper atmosphere. I remember back in the winter, after this eruption, driving one day up to Auckland, the family, and the skies, you know, in the middle of the afternoon, had this pink hue.
A bit eerie.
Oh, it was weird, but they had a pink hue, which reminds you a bit of the bushfires we had about a year or so ago. You know, you get this pink coloration. Mm-hmm. It was all because of all the particulate matter chucked up in the atmosphere by this volcano. And the 92 vintage turned out all right, but it wasn't a super hot summer. But the following summer, 92, 93, we had a spring and then we had an autumn. We didn't have a summer. It was so cold. And it was so cool. The fruit just didn't ripen.
So what do you do in that case?
Oh, and the crops were very, very light. Well, it was a year of poor wine quality, because the fruit just didn't ripen very well. And then in the mid-90s, we had sort of years 95, a big dump of rain. 96, we had a year which wasn't particularly good. 97, not particularly good. But then we had a run of quite good vintages, like 98, that was an El Nino year, so it was one of the hottest years
I think. That was a big El Nino event. I think that it was so strong, that El Nino, that had a big effect on global climate. I think there was a spike in global temperatures that year. But that was like a very, very hot summer, and we'd never experienced anything quite like it. You know, so the fruit got very, very ripe.
And are there more people planting grapes at the moment?
Oh, it's pretty static in Hawke's Bay.
There's still people planting grapes?
Oh, not a lot. There's some. It's static. Because there's not a great awareness of Hawke's Bay red wines overseas, like a Cabernet and Merlot's.
You can't get them overseas?
Oh, no, well, it's just a cost, because we're growing in a cool climate. The cost of producing fruit is quite high. Typically, the cost of a tonne of grapes, good ripe red grapes, is $2,000 or more a tonne. In Australia or South America, Argentina or South Africa, many costs, you can get fruit with modern cost you fifth that.
So do they drink more wine over there?
Well, they've got warmer climates, so for red wine, which is what we're trying to do at the top end, a red wine costs, it's just quite high. So when you do produce a very, very good red wine, it's up against, you know, areas or countries where the cost of production is much, much lower. It's hard to compete. And it's hard to compete with areas like France, where they do have a high standard of living and their costs are higher, but they've got massive subsidies, EU subsidies. We don't have any subsidies. No, the Labour government got rid of the subsidies back in the 80s, didn't they?
They had fun doing that, didn't they? But as I said, New Zealand is such a young country. We haven't got the history like for growing grapes like France and these other countries.
Yeah, but we've come a long way, especially in the last 20 years, with our viticulture. I did a vintage in France in 1985, and it was just the standard and quality of the viticulture, which was just amazing. We've come back here, I think, over the last 20 years, we've made strides, you know, and I think that our fruit quality, when we get it right, like years, like in the last 3 years or so, I think our wines compare with sometimes wines that are, you know, fine French wines, which are much, much more expensive, you know, than ours. So we are actually producing, at the top end, very, very high quality wine, very, very high standard wines that I know will age beautifully for 10 or 20 years, you know, which is the aspiration of some of the great wine-producing regions in France and Italy and Germany. But it's just that our scale is so small, you see. So Merlot and Cabernet and Syrah, all those three varieties, all up in Hawke's Bay, we're producing what, about sort of 15,000 tonnes, you know, which is like such a tiny drop in the ocean compared to, say, like Bordeaux, where they make these styles of wine. So their production is probably going to be 300,000 or 400,000 tonnes of these varieties, and what are we doing? 10,000 or 15,000, because our scale is so small. So because we don't have the scale, there's no awareness of our wines overseas. But the exception to that is Marlborough, where you've got almost a monoculture of Sauvignon Blanc. So there, from Marlborough, I think, you know, well, I think you're looking at 250,000 tonnes of fruit a year, and that's the sort of scale you've got to get up to. That scale, I think, if you're going to actually make a blip in global markets. And Marlborough have done it with Sauvignon Blanc, which is incredible.
How much travel have you done with your job?
Oh, not much, no. I did a vintage in France in 85, but that's all really. Oh, I've had a few trips overseas, yeah. Two or three to Europe, and three or four to conferences and so on in Australia, but yeah, not much.
I see by your age that you could be retired, sir.
Oh, it's something you think about, but I don't know. It's still useful around here, so I might as well carry on working. I've still got a son at home, a 17-year-old son. So, yeah, once he leaves, got to leave next year. Things will change, my position will change a bit, so I've got no plans.
Have you had time for hobbies?
Oh, yeah, I used to do a bit of trout fishing. I was a member of a golf club for a bit. I'm not a really good player. I used to quite enjoy trout fishing quite a bit. Before I married, I used to get into hang gliding for a bit. That's quite good. Since my wife died, I don't know, I just haven't had that much time to engage in hobbies.
So you've got how many children?
Five.
How many girls?
Two.
That'll keep you busy.
Yeah, I've got, yeah, they sort of tend to keep you engaged.
That's good though.
Mm. Yeah, so you talk to them on the phone and stuff, and yeah, they come and visit you from time to time, which is nice, always good.
You're lucky.
Mm. Yeah.
Paul, on behalf of the Knowledge Bank, I'd like to thank you very much for letting me interview you today, and we wish you all the best for the future.
Oh, thank you.